This week on Making Contact.
There was a high level of police abuse, of police harassment. There was a high level of contractors stealing from people.
Hundreds of women in the New York region are banding together to bring about change in the way domestic work is done and viewed.
I had to leave my home, I had to leave my work, I have to leave everything, even my salary. Now I'm living here jobless and, you know, just surviving, that's all.
As the year 2007 comes to an end, we take a look back at three important stories we covered over the past year. Immigrant day laborers and domestic workers organize in New Orleans and New York. And while the U.S. war on Iraq rages on, the Iraqi refugee crisis continues to grow. I'm Puck Lowe, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. It's been 2.5 years since Hurricanes Katrina and Rita hit the Gulf Coast. And despite hopeful signs of renewal, New Orleans and many parts of the Gulf Coast are still in disrepair. Making Contact's senior producer, Tina Rubio, spent time in New Orleans over the last year, speaking to newly arrived populations of migrant and immigrant workers and to grassroots organizers. Here's an excerpt from an award-winning series, New Orleans Now: Immigrants, Labor Rights, and the Human Cost of Rebuilding an American City.
It's 6:30 in the morning. With a coffee in hand, Israel Lopez is standing at the corner near a Lowe's parking lot. It's cold out, but he's wearing only a thin windbreaker. He says he can't afford a new jacket right now because the money he earns he sends back to Veracruz, Mexico. That's where he's from, and that's where his parents live. But he also tells me he doesn't always get paid, and it's not for a lack of work.
Una vez que hicimos una casa entera, no nos la pagaron. En un día no la hicimos, no nos pagaron nada.
One time we built the whole house, and they didn't pay us. One day I took it, and they didn't pay us anything.
Israel arrived in New Orleans a month after the disaster. He specializes in construction. That particular job cost him and another worker $1,500 in time and pay.
No van a pagar y dice que hiciéramos aparte otro trabajo.
He said he was going to pay, but he said we had to do another job in addition to the first job. We had to do some more work besides what we did so that it pays. But that wasn't the deal.
Israel is not alone. Dozens of men on this corner today have similar stories to tell. Stories of untreated injuries, unpaid labor, police harassment, and intimidation. That's where Marco Amador comes in. He's a field worker for the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice, one of a few but influential groups that sprung up after Katrina, helping the influx of immigrant and migrant laborers who arrived to rebuild the city. We met at a cafe in the Bywater.
I am a part of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and we're a national organization that works throughout the country. There's about 35 different member organizations that are spread out from the West Coast to the East Coast and everywhere in between. And the issues we deal with mainly are seeing how we can create spaces where day laborers can organize themselves. To take control of their environment and their work areas and their education.
Marco is from Los Angeles. He came to New Orleans to set up a day labor program modeled off the program in LA. Because until recently, day labor organization and infrastructure was non-existent. Marco says the environment for immigrant workers was ripe for abuse.
And we just realized that there was a high level of police abuse, of police harassment. There was a high level of contractors stealing from people. And there was a really big health and safety issue that was just out of control.
Since Katrina, a very large Latino population has migrated to the New Orleans region. They've come from places like Guatemala, Mexico, Honduras, and Brazil. Some estimates say between 100,000 to 300,000 immigrants arrived in the Gulf region in the months following Katrina.
I do feel that the Latino community and the immigrant community has never been exposed and has never been put in a position like the one they are in here in New Orleans. And I feel, just by being here a couple months, that our community here is in a state of emergency. I think a lot of things are being experimented here. on how to deal with our population, how to deal with our community.
This phenomenon of a low-wage immigrant population is very new to New Orleans. The city has never seen large groups of Latino men standing on street corners waiting for work.
There is about 19 corners in the New Orleans area. So, you know, on any given day you have, you know, a couple thousand people out there looking for work.
Those 19 corners have now turned into more than 30. For many, this is not a welcome sight. I asked Marco to take me to one of the corners so I could find out firsthand what the workers were saying about their own experiences. We left the cafe and ended up at a Lowe's parking lot in Metairie, a city in Jefferson Parish, just outside the French Quarter. Hola. Hola, mi amo Tina. Marco introduced me and explained what we wanted to talk about. Many of these men are wary of the media and are worried that any discussion of who they are might lead to a reporting to INS, or ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents. Having Marco involved, someone they know and trust, made all the difference.
Yo soy el señor José Castillo. Tengo más de un año de estar aquí, o años, dos meses de estar aquí. He luchado por ver... Por ver a los hispanos que triunfen aquí. Ese es mi lema. Luchar, 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 luchar.
I am Mr. Jose Castillo. I've been here more than a year. I've fought so that the Hispanics come out on top here. That's my motto. Fight, 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 fight.
Incluso hay veces que me quedo hasta un mes sin trabajo. Ese es mi lema. Soy guatemalteco. A mí no me interesan las personas de ninguna nación.
Even when I don't have work for a month, that's my motto. I'm Guatemalan. I don't care which country you are from. What I care is that you are a decent person. I don't care if you have money or if you don't. It's not important to me. That's not my problem. Only that you behave decently, that's all. See, I fought because the police here are really racist. They've arrested me twice now, just for fun.
La policía, pues. Una parte me quejo de ellos, pero por otra no, por otra está bien, porque tienen que cuidar aquí todo esto. Pero a veces también se portan.
The police, though, on one hand I have some complaints, but on the other, no, it's okay, because they have to take care of everything here. But sometimes it's really, really ugly the way they behave.
En ocasiones yo perdí mi, me quitaron mi ID de México y me quitaron mi ID que yo traía de Florida. Eran los federales que decían que me dijeron que porque eso no me.
Once they took away my Mexican ID and they took away my ID that I brought from Florida. They were federal agents. They said it wasn't any good here. That here in this country it wasn't any good. So that's why they had to take it. Because here, that ID didn't mean anything. And at that time, I had two chains. They also took those. And I had a cell phone. They also took that away. I didn't have anything left.
Hay veces que se hallan buenos patrones y hay veces que se hallan malos patrones.
Here, sometimes you can find a good boss and sometimes you get a bad boss, you know? That's why around here, anytime you go out to work, that's the first thing you have to request, that they pay you when you finish your job. But there are some that won't pay you. There are some that leave you at the job site and they just leave like it's no big deal.
Pero sí es importante que...
That's why it's important that we get organized somehow here on this corner and on every street corner.
That was our host, Tina Rubio. Immigrant and migrant workers continue to fight for justice in New Orleans to this day. In December, activists with Stop the Demolition Coalition of New Orleans and residents have been fighting the U.S. government's demolition of four major public housing developments. They've conducted marches, sit-ins, and occupied public housing complexes. It's estimated that about 16,000 people are living homeless in New Orleans right now. This past May, we paid tribute to the many working women of color who are struggling for recognition. The excerpt you're going to hear is called Mothers, Migrants, and Maids of Honor. The segment was produced by the New York City-based Community News Production Institute. Mitch Jeserich, now with KPFA's Morning Show, helped to train members of Domestic Workers United to create this piece.
By the time we get home, we're tired. So the children are literally raising their children. Now, me being mindful of that, had to come home and dote on my child, because here it is, I'm giving a stranger love, a stranger I don't even know, right? That child didn't come from me, but how could you not love the child? So you're giving this child all this, and my intellectual mind say, wait a minute, if you could give this to this other child who has nothing to do with you, it's your form of employment. Yes, it is. And you're not shortchanging that child. You have to come and give it three times as much to yours. That was my perception. That is what I believe. That is what I conceive. And it can't fail. I've seen many nannies fail. Our children are raising our children on, themselves at street corners. You know why? Because we come to make that dollar.
We want justice and we want it right now. So listen to what we say.
Domestic work in New York City is done primarily by immigrant women of color. We clean your homes, take care of your children, even walk your dog. Many domestic workers are abused, hired and fired at whim, and are privy to vacation, sick and personal days. Simply put, these women are overworked and underpaid. But we are not victims. We are fighting back. Hundreds of women in the New York region are banding together to bring about change in the way domestic work is done and viewed. Earlene Brown, a nanny, is one of those women.
Because there's so much abuse out there, and the abuse has been going on for so many years, because there's so many people that spend so much time taking care of the children, and when the children get sick, they get sick, then they're not paid for it. Because when it comes to holidays such as the 4th of July, Thanksgiving, they're told, well, you're not an American, so I don't see why you should get it off with pay. Because there's so many people that's been working in other people's homes and they've been injured. And when they cannot work, they're just let go with no severance, no sick days, no personal days, nothing. That's why. And because it's been going on for too long. It's been going on from the time they took the Africans out of Africa and they brought them in the homes and they put the men in the field. These two jobs have never been addressed. No one's ever gone back to correct the wrong that's been done. And people believe now that this is a time to make change. It's been going on for too long.
Earlene is a member of Domestic Workers United, an organization made up and run by domestic workers. It was created in New York just 6 years ago. One of the campaigns that Domestic Workers United has rallied around is the case of Marina Lopez. Marina took care of a 14-year-old disabled boy whose parents, the DiMartinos, were wealthy restaurant owners. The parents did not always pay the 66-year-old Marina, who was expected to lift and carry the teenager in and out and around the house. But what was worse, Marina says, was where she was forced to spend the nights.
Bueno, y lo más duro para mí fue que me tocaba dormir en un Bayman.
The hardest thing for me, actually, was having to sleep in the basement. And what happened in that basement was that the sewage overflowed, and so everything was all over the floor, and I had to sleep there. And I had to go out looking for leaves, cardboard, anything, so that I could walk over everything that was on the floor in order to get back up to the house so that I could continue my household chores.
Marina is also the mother of two disabled children back in her home country of Colombia. She left them to be cared for by others so that she can earn enough money in the States to help pay for the necessary things her children need. Domestic Workers United frequently shows up just outside the Di Martino's restaurant in Queens to pressure Marina's former employer to pay her back wages that was owed to her, as well as let patrons know who they are eating from.
Respect your workers. Shame on Martino. Shame, shame, who? Shame on Martino. I don't want to hear this kind of stuff anymore. We will come back. We'll destroy your business. And then we'll come again.
We'll be back. We'll be back.
We'll be back.
Another front of Domestic Workers United campaign is in the state legislature in Albany. They are working on persuading lawmakers to urge them to pass a measure known as Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. Joyce Campbell is a nanny and a DWU steering committee member.
The Bill of Rights is asking for a minimum wage of $14 per hour, paid sickness days, paid vacation, personal days. We're asking for severance pay because after 3 years, Marina has put in, and she was not even given as much as a thank you note. And we have domestic workers who put in 9 and 10 years, and then they don't even get a thank you, like I just said. Sometimes they go to work, and the doorman say to them, your boss said to me, you're not needed anymore.
We want justice and we want it right now, so listen to what we say.
Women in the domestic work industry are still working the shadows of slavery. These women are mothers who have left their families in Ecuador, Malaysia, the Congos, and the Caribbean to come and be mothers to new families in this land internationally known as the land of opportunities, all the while knowing it will be a long time until they see their own families again. These mothers work hard, taking care of others' most prized possessions, the children and their homes. All they ask is to be compensated fairly and to gain respect and justice in the workplace. For Making Contact, I'm Radha Kannan, along with Christine Lewis, with the Community News Production Institute.
Since this report, Domestic Workers United and 12 other groups have formed a national coalition of domestic workers organizations to provide new spirit and direction to the struggle of domestic workers and others who fight for economic justice. We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. It's been almost 3.5 years since the U.S. began its shock and awe bombing campaign and subsequent occupation of Iraq. In addition to civilian casualties, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been forced to flee their war-torn country to nearby neighboring countries. Countries that either don't want them or can't provide for them. In July, Making Contact's Dar Jamail brought us the story about Iraqis seeking refuge in Damascus, Syria. It's called The Growing Iraqi Refugee Crisis.
Since the U.S. launched its invasion of Iraq in March 2003, nearly one out of every seven Iraqis has had to flee his or her home due to the violence and chaos. But where do they go? Recent UN estimates show the number of Iraqis seeking refuge in neighboring countries continues to climb, with nearly 1 million in Jordan, more than 80,000 in Egypt, and at least 200,000 others scattered throughout the Gulf region. That's more than 2 million uprooted and homeless people seeking shelter and safety from the Iraq war zone. And this is in addition to the nearly 2 million Iraqis who are displaced within their own country. For comparison's sake, the Bush administration has issued a scant 466 U.S. visas to Iraqis since the occupation began.
I'm asking Bush. He catch one Iraqi coming to USA, killed American people. Why he's coming to Iraq to kill our people? He coming to Iraq to killing all the Iraqi people. Why? If Saddam Hussein, he's not good man, but the Iraqis, why he's kill the Iraqi people?
Abu Noor is a 63-year-old refugee in Bulan City, 25 miles northwest of Damascus. Sitting in the sun on a quiet patio in the mountains, the peaceful scene is out of context with the situation he describes. Abu Noor is a former teacher whose life was destroyed by the occupation. He fled Baghdad after receiving death threats from sectarian death squads. Countless refugees are like 59-year-old Adnan. He left everything behind in Baghdad when he fled in April 2006. He says his whole life was erased, but he's grateful to be alive. And while safe for the time being in Syria, he doesn't know what to do next.
I left everything there. My car, my house, my furniture. I didn't bring anything with me. This is what perplexes me, the unknown future. My money is going to end and I have to go back and I will be killed. This is the truth. Yes, unfortunately.
United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Syria is desperately underfunded and short-staffed. The 2006 budget for Iraqi refugees was a bare 700,000, providing about a dollar for each refugee who crossed the border. The 2007 budget was 16 million. An improvement, yes, but when you work out the numbers, it translates into about $13 a year for each refugee. That's hardly going to ease the suffering or make a dent in the complex needs of refugees fleeing a war zone. And the prospects continue to be dismal. UNHCR recently estimated that almost 3 million Iraqis will be displaced by the end of this year. And right now, Syria is the only nation with an open-door policy toward Iraqi refugees.
I worked in Balad General Hospital, that is a town lying 50 kilometers north of Baghdad. And I used to be there as a general practitioner and a resident of the surgical department as well. And I had to leave Balad for being threatened personally by name, by some insurgents or some militias. I haven't been able to recognize who was the threatener. I was threatened to be killed if I remained there. So I had to leave in Baghdad in Iraq as whole.
That's Dr. Al-Khattab. He left Baghdad in April 2006. He's among the reported 40% of Iraq's middle class who fled the country. And like so many of them, his attempts to find work both in Syria and elsewhere have proven fruitless. We spoke in a mostly empty one-room apartment he shares with his father, his brother, and some other refugees.
I had to leave my home, I had to leave my work, I have to leave everything, even my salary. Now I'm living here jobless and, you know, just surviving, that's all. During my work in Iraq, I have managed to save some funds now, which I'm depending on. I don't know how long would that be enough for me. And I have applied for many websites. I have applied through many sites. I've applied for work in the Gulf and the KSA specifically, but they said they don't give visas to Iraqis. I have applied to here in the Syrian government, but they have agreed partially, but they put me into some security stuff that will not finish until, I think, a decade or so.
With his meager savings running out, Dr. Al-Khattab's future is uncertain. Yet he's trying to do what he can to help other refugees in need of his medical skills.
So what I'm doing now, I'm offering some free medical advices, some free medical aids to Iraqis here who are in need of medical help. That's just for free and to practice my work, that's all. I think too, I came here 1 year ago, and I can assure you this: the number when I came has truly tripled, not doubled. I can assure you that. I mean, every day we stand at the square over there and we watch the Suburban's car bringing Iraqis. Then there is a range about 10 to 15 Suburban, each one carrying about 5 to 6 personnel arriving every day just to this neighborhood. I don't know. I think my place is to be in the hospital serving patients and to have some future that is at least equal to to other doctors' futures in the world, but not so much different. But if you ask any Iraqi doctor who's right now working in Yemen or in anywhere else, they will tell you we have a very dark future. We don't know what's going to happen.
Year-old Abdulaziz blames the UN along with the United States for the growing crisis in his country. He spoke with me softly yet deliberately inside his stationery store near another busy market in Damascus.
الأمم المتحدة الراعية للسلام ما في سلام نهائيا بالشرق الأوسط من تقتيل العراقيين وتهجيرهم من بلدهم فلسطين.
The UN has a very big role in achieving peace. Where is the peace? The Iraqis are suffering a lot, the Lebanese are suffering, everybody is suffering, and there is no role of the UN. I would like to tell the American people, in Bush especially, that whatever force they use, it's not good to attack these Arab countries.
And so the flood of refugees continues. Every month, more than 30,000 Iraqis stream across the Syrian border seeking peace and a chance to restart their lives. And the crisis continues to deepen as the U.S.-led occupation of Iraq grinds on without an end in sight. With new refugees arriving in Damascus daily, those already there, like Dr. Al-Khattab, have little hope for their own futures or for the future of their country.
That was correspondent Dar Jamail. The refugee crisis continues to be a huge humanitarian disaster. Although Syria originally welcomed displaced Iraqis, Syrians say their own resources have been stretched too thin. As a result, many Iraqis continue to find themselves without housing or a job. Human rights groups say the U.S. is to blame and should pay to resettle the displaced populations. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 5207, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, senior producer, Samson Rainey and Elena Botkin-Levy, interns. And I'm your host and associate producer, Puck Lowe. And from all of us at Making Contact, have a Happy New Year.